office a maligned and controversial figure after two exhausting terms, almost surprised by how poorly it had gone. After the presidency, Grant invested almost every penny he had to create a financial brokerage house with a controversial investor named Ferdinand Ward. Ward, a Bernie Madoff of his day, turned it into a Ponzi scheme and publicly bankrupted Grant. As Sherman wrote with sympathy and understanding of his friend, Grant had aimed to rival the millionaires who would have given their all to have won any of his battles. Grant had accomplished so much, but to him it wasn't enough. He couldn't decide what was important, what actually mattered to him. That's how it seems to go. We're never happy with what we have. We want what others have too. We want to have more than everyone else. We start out knowing what is important to us, but once we've achieved it, we lose sight of our priorities. Ego sways us and can ruin us. Compelled by a sense of honor to cover the debts of the firm, Grant took out a loan using his priceless war mementos as collateral. Broken in mind, spirit, and body, the last years of his life found him battling painful throat cancer and racing to finish his memoirs so that he might leave his family with something to live on. He made it, just barely. One shudders to think of the vital forces drained from this hero, who died at just 63 in agony and defeat, the straightforward, honest man who just couldn't help himself, who couldn't manage to focus, and ended up far outside the bounds of his ample genius. What could he have done with those years instead? How might America have looked otherwise? How much more could he have done and accomplished? Not that he is unique in this regard. All of us regularly say yes, unthinkingly, or out of vague attraction, or out of greed or vanity, because we can't say no, because we might miss out on something if we did. We think that yes will let us accomplish more, when in reality it prevents exactly what we seek. All of us waste precious life doing things we don't like to prove ourselves to people we don't respect and to get things we don't want. Why do we do this? Well, it should be obvious by now. Ego leads to envy and it rots the bones of people big and small. Ego undermines greatness by diluting its holder. Most of us begin with a clear idea of what we want in life. We know what's important to us. The success we achieve, especially if it comes earlier in abundance, puts us in an unusual place. Because now, all of a sudden, we're in a new place and have trouble keeping our bearings. The farther you travel down that path of accomplishment, whatever it may be, the more often you meet other successful people who make you feel insignificant. It doesn't matter how well you're doing, your ego and their accomplishments make you feel like nothing, just as others make them feel the same way. It's a cycle that goes on ad infinitum. While our brief time on Earth, or the small window of opportunity we have here, does not. So we unconsciously pick up the pace to keep up with others. But what if other people are running for different reasons? What if there is more than one race going on? That's what Sherman was saying about Grant. There's a certain gift of the magi irony in how badly we chase what will not be truly pleasurable. At the very least, it won't last. If only we could all stop for a second. Let's be clear. Competitiveness is an important force in life. It's what drives the market and is behind some of mankind's most impressive accomplishments. On an individual level, however, it's absolutely critical that you know who you are competing with and why, that you have a clear sense of the space you're in. Only you know the race you're running. That is, unless your ego decides that the only way you have value is if you're better than, have more than, everyone, everywhere. More urgently, each one of us has a unique potential and purpose. That means we're the only ones who can evaluate and set the terms of our lives. Far too often, we look at other people and make their approval the standard we feel compelled to meet, and as a result, squander our very potential and purpose. According to Seneca, the Greek word eutemia is one we should think of often. It is the sense of our own path and how to stay on it without getting distracted by all the others that intersect it. In other words, it's not about beating the other guy. It's not about having more than the others. It's about being what you are and being as good as possible at it without succumbing to all the things that draw you away from it. It's about going where you set out to go, about accomplishing the most you're capable of in what you choose. That's it. No more, no less. By the way, eutimia means tranquility in English. It's time to sit down and think about what's truly important to you and then take steps to forsake the rest. Without this, success will not be pleasurable or nearly as complete as it could be. Or worse, it won't last. This is especially true with money. If you don't know how much you need, the default easily becomes more. And so without thinking, critical energy is diverted from a person's calling and toward filling a bank account. When you combine insecurity and ambition, the plagiarist and disgraced journalist Joan Allaire said when reflecting back on his fall, you get an inability to say no to things. Ego rejects trade-offs. Why compromise? Ego wants it all. Ego tells you to cheat, even though you love your spouse, because you want what you have and what you don't have. Ego says that sure, even though you're just starting to get the hang of one thing, why not jump right in the middle of another? Eventually you say yes to too much, to something far beyond the pale. We're like Captain Ahab, chasing Moby Dick for reasons we don't even understand anymore. Maybe your priority actually is money, or maybe it's family, or maybe it's influence or change. Maybe it's building an organization that lasts or serves a purpose. All of these are perfectly fine motivations, but you do need to know. You need to know what you don't want and what your choices preclude, because strategies are often mutually exclusive. One cannot be an opera singer and a teen pop idol at the same time. Life requires trade-offs, but ego can't allow it. So why do you do what you do? That's the question you need to answer. Stare at it until you can. Only then will you understand what matters and what doesn't. Only then can you say no, can you opt out of stupid races that don't matter or even exist. Only then is it easy to ignore successful people, because most of the time they aren't, at least relative to you, and often even to themselves. Only then can you develop the quiet confidence Seneca talked about. The more you have and do, the harder maintaining fidelity to your purpose will be, but the more critically you will need to. Everyone buys into the myth that if only they had that, usually what someone else has, they would be happy. It may take getting burned a few times to realize the emptiness of this illusion. We all occasionally find ourselves in the middle of some project or obligation and can't understand why we're there. It will take courage and faith to stop yourself. Find out why you're after what you're after. Ignore those who mess with your pace. Let them covet what you have, not the other way around, because that's independence. Entitlement, control, and paranoia. One of the symptoms of approaching nervous breakdown is the belief that one's work is terribly important. Bertrand Russell. When Xerxes, the Persian emperor, crossed the Hellespont during his invasion of Greece, the waters surged up and destroyed the bridges his engineers had spent days building. So he threw chains into the river, ordered it to be given 300 lashes, and branded it with hot irons. As his men delivered his punishment, they were ordered to harangue it. "You salt and bitter stream, your master lays this punishment upon you for injuring him, who never injured you." Oh, and he cut off the heads of the men who built the bridges. Herodotus, the great historian, called the display presumptuous, which is probably an understatement. Surely preposterous and delusional are more appropriate. Then again, it was part of his personality. Shortly before this, Xerxes had written a letter to a nearby mountain in which he needed to cut a canal. "You may be tall and proud," he wrote, "but don't you dare cause me any trouble. Otherwise, I'll topple you into the sea." How hilarious is that? More important, how pathetic. Xerxes' delusional threats are unfortunately not a historical anomaly. With success, particularly power, come some of the greatest and most dangerous delusions: entitlement, control, and paranoia. Hopefully you won't find yourself so crazed that you start anthropomorphizing and inflicting retribution on inanimate objects. That's pure, recognizable crazy, and thankfully rare. What's more likely and more common is we begin to overestimate our own power. Then we lose perspective. Eventually, we can end like Xerxes, a monstrous joke. The strongest poison ever known, the poet William Blake wrote, came from Caesar's laurel crown. Success casts a spell over us. The problem lies in the path that got us to success in the first place. What we've accomplished often required feats of raw power and force of will. Both entrepreneurship and art require the creation of something where nothing existed before. Wealth means beating the market and the odds. Athletic champions have proved their physical superiority over opponents. Achieving success involved ignoring the doubts and reservations of the people around us. It meant rejecting rejection. It required taking certain risks. We could have given up at any time, but we're here precisely because we didn't. Persistence and courage in the face of ridiculous odds are partially irrational traits, in some cases really irrational. But when it works, those tendencies can feel like they've been vindicated. And why shouldn't they? It's human to think that since it's been done once, that the world was changed in some big or small way, that there's now a magical power in our possession. We're here because we're bigger, stronger, smarter. That we make the reality we inhabit. Right before he destroyed his own billion-dollar company, Ty Warner, creator of Beanie Babies, overrode the cautious objections of one of his employees and bragged, "I could put the Ty heart on manure and they'd buy it." He was wrong. And the company not only catastrophically failed, he later narrowly missed going to jail. It doesn't matter if you're a billionaire, a millionaire, or just a kid who snagged a good job early. The complete and utter sense of certainty that got you here can become a liability if you're not careful. The demands and dream you had for a better life, the ambition that fueled your effort, these begin as earnest drives, but left unchecked become hubris and entitlement. The same goes for the instinct to take charge. Now you're addicted to control, driven to prove the doubters wrong. Welcome to the seeds of paranoia. Yes, there are legitimate stresses and anguish that come with the responsibilities of your new life. All the things you're managing, the frustrating mistakes of people who should know better, the endless creep of obligations, no one prepares us for that, which makes the feelings all the harder to deal with. The promised land was supposed to be nice, not aggravating, but you can't let the walls close in on you. You've got to get yourself and your perceptions under control. When Arthur Lee was sent to France and England to serve as one of America's diplomats during the Revolutionary War, instead of relishing the opportunity to work with his fellow diplomat Silas Deane and elder statesman Benjamin Franklin, he raged and resented them and suspected them of disliking him. Finally, Franklin wrote him a letter, one that we've probably all deserved to get at one point or another. "If you don't cure yourself of this temper," Franklin advised, "it will end in insanity, of which it is the symptomatic forerunner." Probably because he was in such command of his own temper, Franklin decided that writing the letter was cathartic enough. He never sent it. If you've ever listened to the Oval Office tapes of Richard Nixon, you can hear the same sickness, and you wish someone could have sent him such a letter. It's a harrowing insight into a man who's lost his grip not just on what he is legally allowed to do, on what his job was, to serve the people, but on reality itself. He vacillates wildly from supreme confidence to dread and fear. He talks over his subordinates and rejects information and feedback that challenges what he wants to believe. He lives in a bubble in which no one can say no, not even his conscience. There's a letter from General Winfield Scott to Jefferson Davis, then the Secretary of War for the United States. Davis belligerently pestered Scott repeatedly about some trivial matter. Scott ignored it until finally, forced to address it, he wrote that he pitied Davis. "Compassion is always due," he said to him, "to an enraged imbecile who lays about him in blows which only hurt himself." Ego is its own worst enemy. It hurts the ones we love, too. Our friends and families suffer for it. So do our customers, fans, and clients. A critic of Napoleon nailed it when remarking, "He despises the nation whose applause he seeks." He couldn't help but see the French people as pieces to be manipulated, people he had to be better than, people who, unless they were totally unconditionally supportive of him, were against him. A smart man or woman must regularly remind themselves of the limits of their power and reach. Entitlement assumes, this is mine, I've earned it. At the same time, entitlement nickels and dimes other people because it can't conceive of valuing another person's time as highly as its own. It delivers tirades and pronouncements that exhaust the people who work for and with us, who have no choice other than to go along. It overstates our abilities to ourselves, it renders generous judgment of our prospects, and it creates ridiculous expectations. Control says, it must be done my way, even little things, even inconsequential things. It can be paralyzing perfectionism, or a million pointless battles fought merely for the sake of exerting its say. It too exhausts people whose help we need, particularly quiet people who don't object until we've pushed them to their breaking point. We fight with the clerk at the airport, the customer service representative on the telephone, the agent who examines our claim. To what end? In reality, we don't control the weather, we don't control the market, we don't control other people, and our efforts and energies in spite of us are pure waste. Paranoia thinks, I can't trust anyone. I'm in this totally by myself and for myself. It says, I'm surrounded by fools. It says, focusing on my work, my obligations, myself is not enough. I also have to be orchestrating various machinations behind the scenes to get them before they get me, to get them back for the slights I perceive. Everyone has had a boss, a partner, a parent like this. All that strife, anger, chaos, and conflict. How did it go for them? How did it end? He who indulges empty fears earns himself real fears, wrote Seneca, who was a political advisor witness to destructive paranoia at the highest levels. The sad feedback loop is that the relentless looking out for number one can encourage other people to undermine and fight us. They see that behavior for what it is, a mask for weakness, insecurity, and instability. In its frenzy to protect itself, paranoia creates the persecution it seeks to avoid, making the owner a prisoner of its own delusions and chaos. Is this the freedom you envisioned when you dreamed of your success? Likely not. So stop. Managing yourself. It is not enough to have great qualities. We should also have the management of them. La Rochefoucauld. In 1953, Dwight D. Eisenhower returned from his inaugural parade and entered the White House for the first time as president late in the evening. As he walked into the executive mansion, his chief usher handed Eisenhower two letters marked confidential and secret that had been sent to him earlier in the day. Eisenhower's reaction was swift. "Never bring me a sealed envelope," he said firmly. "That's what I have a staff for." How snobbish, right? Had the office really gone to his head already? Not at all. Eisenhower recognized the seemingly insignificant event for what it was, a symptom of a disorganized, dysfunctional organization. Not everything needed to run through him. Who's to say that the envelope was even important? Why hadn't anyone screened it? As president, his first priority in office was organizing the executive branch into a smooth, functioning, and order-driven unit, just like his military units had been. Not because he didn't want to work himself, but because everyone had a job and he trusted and empowered them to do it. As his chief of staff later put it, "The president does the most important things. I do the next most important things." The public image of Eisenhower is of the man playing golf. In reality, he was not someone who ever slacked off, but the leisure time he did have was available because he ran a tight ship. He knew that urgent and important were not synonyms. His job was to set the priorities, to think big picture, and then trust the people beneath him to do the jobs they were hired for. Most of us are not the president, or even president of a company, but in moving up the ladder in life, the system and work habits that got us where we are won't necessarily keep us there. When we're aspiring or small time, we can be idiosyncratic. We can compensate for disorganization with hard work and a little luck. That's not going to cut it in the majors. In fact, it'll sink you if you can't grow up and organize. We can contrast Eisenhower's system in the White House with the infamous car company created by John DeLorean when he walked away from GM to produce his brand of futuristic cars. A few decades removed from the company's spectacular implosion, we can be forgiven for thinking the man was just ahead of his time. In fact, his rise and fall is as timeless a story as there is. Power-hungry narcissist undermines his own vision and loses millions of dollars of other people's money in the process. DeLorean was convinced that the culture of order and discipline at GM had held brilliant creatives like himself down. When he set out to found his company, he deliberately did everything differently, flouting conventional wisdom and business practices. The result was not the freewheeling creative sanctuary that DeLorean naively envisioned. It was, instead, an overbearingly political, dysfunctional, and even corrupt organization that collapsed under its own weight, eventually resorting to criminality and fraud and losses of some $250 million. The DeLorean failed as both a car and as a company because it was mismanaged from top to bottom, with an emphasis on the mismanagement at the top by the top. That is, DeLorean himself was the problem. Compared to Eisenhower, he worked constantly with very different results. As one executive put it, DeLorean had the ability to recognize a good opportunity, but he didn't know how to make it happen. Another executive described his management style as chasing colored balloons. He was constantly distracted and abandoning one project for another. He was a genius. Sadly, that's rarely enough. Though probably not on purpose, DeLorean created a culture in which ego ran free. Convinced that continued success was simply his by right, he seemed to bristle at concepts like discipline, organization, or strategic planning. Employees were not given enough direction, and then at other times overwhelmed with trivial instructions. DeLorean couldn't delegate, except to lackeys whose blind loyalty was prized over competence or skill. On top of all this, he was often late or preoccupied. Executives were allowed to work on extracurricular activities on the company dime, encouraged specifically to chase side projects that benefited their boss at the expense of the company. As CEO, DeLorean often bent the truth to investors, fellow officers, and suppliers, and this habit was contagious throughout the company. Like many people driven by a demon, DeLorean's decisions were motivated by everything but what would have been efficient, manageable, or responsible. Instead of improving or fixing GM's system, it's as if he threw out order altogether. What ensued was chaos in which no one ever followed the rules, no one was accountable, and very little got done. The only reason it didn't collapse immediately was that DeLorean was a master of public relations, a skill that held the whole story together until the first faulty cars came off the assembly line. Not surprisingly, the cars were terrible. They didn't work, cost per unit was massively over budget, they hadn't secured enough dealers, they couldn't deliver cars to the ones they had. The launch was a disaster. DeLorean Motor Company never recovered. It turns out that becoming a great leader is difficult. Who knew? DeLorean couldn't manage himself, so he had trouble managing others. And so he managed to fail, both himself and the dream. Management? That's the reward for all your creativity and new ideas? Becoming the man? Yes, in the end, we all face becoming the adult supervision we originally rebelled against. Yet often we react petulantly and prefer to think, now that I'm in charge, things are going to be different. Think about Eisenhower. He was the damn president, the most powerful man in the world. He could have kicked back and done things how he liked. If he was disorganized, people would have had to just deal with it. There have been plenty of those presidents before. Yet he wasn't. He understood that order and responsibility were what the country needed, and that this far outweighed his own concerns. What was so sad about DeLorean is that, like a lot of talented people, his ideas were on point. His car was an exciting innovation. His model could have worked. He had all the assets and the talent. It was his ego and disorganization that resulted from it that prevented the ingredients from coming together, just as they do for so many of us. As you become successful in your own field, your responsibilities may begin to change. Days become less and less about doing and more about making decisions. Such is the nature of leadership. This transition requires reevaluating and updating your identity. It requires a certain humility to put aside some of the more enjoyable or satisfying parts of your previous job. It means accepting that others might be more qualified or specialized in areas in which you considered yourself competent, or at least their time is better spent on them than yours. Yes, it would be more fun to be constantly involved in every tiny matter, and might make us feel important to be the person called to put out fires. The little things are endlessly engaging and often flattering, while the big picture can be hard to discern. It's not always fun, but it is the job. If you don't think big picture because you're too busy playing boss man, who will? Of course, there is no right system. Sometimes systems are better decentralized. Sometimes they are better on a strict hierarchy. Every project and goal deserves an approach fitted perfectly to what needs to be done. Maybe a creative, relaxed environment makes the most sense for what you're doing. Maybe you can run your business remotely. Maybe it's better for everyone to see each other face to face. What matters is that you learn how to manage yourself and others before your industry eats you alive. Micromanagers are egotists who can't manage others, and they quickly get overloaded. So do the charismatic visionaries who lose interest when it's time to execute. Worst yet are those who surround themselves with yes-men or sycophants who clean up their messes and create a bubble in which they can't even see how disconnected from reality they are. Responsibility requires a readjustment and then increased clarity and purpose. First, setting the top-level goals and priorities of the organization in your life. Then enforcing and observing them to produce results and only results. A fish stinks from the head, is the saying. Well, you're the head now. Beware the disease of me. If I am not for myself, who will be for me? If I am only for myself, who am I? Hillel. There were the great Allied generals of World War II, Patton, Bradley, Montgomery, Eisenhower, MacArthur, Zhukov, and then there was George Catlett Marshall, Jr. Although all of them served their countries and fought and led bravely, one stands apart. Today we see World War II as a clear fight in which good aligns selflessly against evil. The problem is that victory and the passage of time have obscured the all-too-humanness of the people who are on the right side of that fight. That is, we forget the politics, the backstabbing, the spotlight coveting, the posturing, the greed, and the ass-covering among the Allies. While the other generals protected their turf, fought with each other, and eagerly aspired to their place in history, that behavior was virtually absent in one man, General George Marshall. More impressively, Marshall quietly outpaced all of them with the magnitude of his accomplishments. What was his secret? Pat Riley, the famous coach and manager who led the Los Angeles Lakers and the Miami Heat to multiple championships, says that great teams tend to follow a trajectory. When they start, before they have won, a team is innocent. If the conditions are right, they come together, they watch out for each other, and work together toward their collective goal. This stage, he calls the innocent climb. After a team starts to win and media attention begins, the simple bonds that joined the individuals together begin to fray. Players calculate their own importance. Chests swell. Frustrations emerge. Egos appear. The innocent climb, Pat Riley says, is almost always followed by the disease of me. It can strike any winning team in any year at any moment, and it does with alarming regularity. It's Shaq and Kobe unable to play together. It's Jordan punching Steve Kerr, Horace Grant, and Will Perdue, his own team members. He punched people on his own team. It's Enron employees plunging California into darkness for personal profit. It's leaks to the media from a disgruntled executive hoping to scuttle a project he dislikes. It's negging and every other intimidation tactic. For us, it's beginning to think that we're better, that we're special, that our problems and experiences are so incredibly different from everyone else's that no one could possibly understand. It's an attitude that has sunk far better people, teams, and causes than ours. With General Marshall, who began his term as Chief of Staff of the U.S. Army on the day Germany invaded Poland in 1939 and served through the entire war, we see one of history's few exceptions to this trend. Marshall somehow never caught the disease of me, and in many ways, often shamed it out of the people who did. It begins with his balanced relationship to rank, an obsession for most people in his line of work. He was not a man who abstained from every public show of rank or status. He insisted that the president call him General Marshall, not George, for example. He'd earned it, right? But while other generals regularly lobbied for promotions, General MacArthur, for example, advanced over other officers in the pre-war years largely due to the aggressive efforts of his mother, Marshall actively discouraged it. When others began to push for Marshall to be chief of staff, he asked them to stop, because it makes me conspicuous in the army. Too conspicuous, in fact, he said. Later, he discouraged an effort by the House to pass a bill awarding him the rank of Field Marshal, not only because he thought the name Field Marshal Marshall would sound ridiculous, but because he didn't want to outrank or hurt his mentor, General Pershing, who was near death and a constant source of advice and guidance. Can you imagine? In all these cases, his sense of honor meant turning down honors and often letting them go to other people. Like any normal human being, he wanted them, only the right way. More important, he knew that, however nice they would have been to have, he could do without them, while perhaps others could not. Ego needs honors in order to be validated. Confidence, on the other hand, is able to wait and focus on the task at hand, regardless of external recognition. Early on in our careers, we may be able to make these sacrifices more easily. We can drop out of a prestigious college to start our own company, or we can tolerate being looked over once in a while. Once we've made it, the tendency is to switch to the mindset of getting what's mine. Now all of a sudden awards and recognition matter. Even though they weren't what got us here, we need that money, that title, that media attention, not for the team or for the cause, but for ourselves, because we've earned it. Let's make one thing clear. We never earn the right to be greedy or to pursue our interests at the expense of everyone else. To think otherwise is not only egotistical, it's counterproductive. Marshall was tested on this to the extreme. A job he'd trained his whole life for was up for grabs. Command of the troops on D-Day, essentially the largest coordinated invasion the world had ever seen. Roosevelt let it be known that it was Marshall's if he wanted it. A general's place in history is assured by his feats in battle, so even though Marshall was needed in Washington, Roosevelt wanted to give him the opportunity to take command. Marshall would have none of it. "The decision is yours, Mr. President," he said. "My wishes have nothing to do with the matter." The role and the glory went to Eisenhower instead. It came to be that Eisenhower was, in fact, the best man for that job. He performed superbly and helped win the war. Would anything else have been worth the trade-off? Yet this is what we regularly refuse to do. Our ego precludes serving any larger mission we're part of. What are we going to do? Let someone get one over on us? The writer Cheryl Strayed once told a young reader, "You're becoming who you're going to be, and so you might as well not be an asshole." This is one of the most dangerous ironies of success. It can make us someone we never wanted to be in the first place. The disease of me can corrupt the most innocent climb. There was a general who treated Marshall poorly, essentially banishing him to some obscure postings in the middle of his career. Later, Marshall surpassed him and had his chance for revenge. Except he didn't take it, because whatever the man's flaws, Marshall saw that he was still of use and that the country would be worse off without him. What were the thanks for this quiet suppression of ego? Just another job well done, and not much more. The word for that is one we don't use much anymore, magnanimous. It was a good strategy too, of course, but mostly Marshall was gracious, forgiving, and magnanimous because it was right. According to observers as high up as President Truman, what separated Marshall from nearly everyone else in the military and in politics is that, quote, never did George Marshall think about himself. There's another story of Marshall sitting for one of the many official portraits that was required of him. After appearing many times and patiently honoring the requests, Marshall was finally informed by the painter that he was finished and free to go. Marshall stood up and began to leave. "Don't you want to see the painting?" the artist asked. "No, thank you," Marshall said respectfully and left. Is that to say that managing your image isn't important? Of course not. Early in your career, you'll notice that you jump on every opportunity to do so. As you become more accomplished, you'll realize that so much of it is a distraction from your work. Time spent with reporters, with awards, and with marketing are time away from what you really care about. Who has time to look at a picture of himself? What's the point? As his wife later observed, the people who saw George Marshall as simply modest or quiet missed what was special about the man. He had the same traits that everyone has: ego, self-interest, pride, dignity, ambition. But they were tempered by a sense of humility and selflessness, she said. It doesn't make you a bad person to want to be remembered, to want to make it to the top, to provide for yourself and your family. After all, that's all part of the allure. There's a balance. Soccer coach Tony Adams expresses it well. Play for the name on the front of the jersey, he says, and they'll remember the name on the back. When it comes to Marshall, the old idea that selflessness and integrity could be weakness or hold someone back are laughably disproven. Sure, some people might have trouble telling you much about him, but each and every one of them lives in a world he was largely responsible for shaping. The credit? Who cares? Meditate on the immensity. A monk is a man who is separated from all and who is in harmony with all. Evagrius Ponticus. In 1879, the preservationist and explorer John Muir took his first trip to Alaska. As he explored the fjords and rocky landscape of Alaska's now famous Glacier Bay, a powerful feeling struck him all at once. He'd always been in love with nature, and here in the unique summer climate of the far north, in this single moment, it was as if the entire world was in sync. As if he could see the entire ecosystem and the circle of life before him. His pulse began to pick up, and as he said, he and the group were warmed and quickened into sympathy with everything, taken back into the heart of nature, from which we all came. Thankfully, Muir noticed and recorded in his journal the beautiful cohesion of the world around him, which few have ever matched since. As he said, "We feel the life and motion about us, and the universal beauty, the tides marching back and forth with weariless industry, laving the beautiful shores, and swaying the purple dulse of the broad meadows of the sea where the fishes are fed, the wild streams in rows white with waterfalls, ever in bloom and ever in song, spreading their branches over 1,000 mountains, the vast forests feeding on the drenching sunbeams, every cell in a whirl of enjoyment, misty flocks of insects stirring all the air, the wild sheep and the goats on the grassy ridges above the woods, bears in the berry tangles, mink and beaver and otter far back on many a river and lake, Indians and adventurers pursuing their lonely ways, birds tending to their young, everywhere, everywhere, beauty and life, and glad, rejoicing action." In this moment, he was experiencing what the Stoics would call sympatheia, a connectedness with the cosmos. The French philosopher Pierre Hadot has referred to it as the oceanic feeling, a sense of belonging to something larger, of realizing that human things are an infinitesimal point in the immensity, as he put it. It is in these moments that we're not only free but drawn toward important questions. Who am I? What am I doing? What is my role in this world? Nothing draws us away from those questions like material success. When we are always busy, stressed, put upon, distracted, reported to, relied on, apart from. When we're wealthy and we're told we're important or powerful. Ego tells us that meaning comes from activity, that being the center of attention is the only way to matter. When we lack a connection to anything larger or bigger than us, it's like a piece of our soul is gone. Like we've detached ourselves from the traditions we hail from, whatever that happens to be. A craft, a sport, a brother or sisterhood, a family. Ego blocks us from the beauty and history in the world. It stands in the way. No wonder we find success empty. No wonder we're exhausted. No wonder it feels like we're on a treadmill. No wonder we lose touch with the energy that once fueled us. Here's an exercise. Walk onto an ancient battlefield or a place of historical significance. Look at the statues and you can't help but see how similar the people look, how little has changed since then, since before, and how it will be forever after. Here a great man once stood. Here another brave woman died. Here a cruel rich man lived, in this palatial home. It's the sense that others have been here before you, generations of them, in fact. In those moments, we have a sense of the immensity of the world. Ego is impossible because we realize, only fleetingly, what Emerson meant when he said that every man is a quotation from all his ancestors. They are a part of us. We are a part of a tradition. Embrace the power of this position and learn from it. It is an exhilarating feeling to grasp this, like the one that Muir felt in Alaska. Yes, we are small. We are also a piece of this great universe and a process. The astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson has described this duality well. It's possible to bask in both your relevance and irrelevance to the cosmos. As he says, when I look up in the universe, I know I'm small, but I'm also big. I'm big because I'm connected to the universe, and the universe is connected to me. We just can't forget which is bigger and which has been here longer. Why do you think that great leaders and thinkers throughout history have gone out into the wilderness and come back with inspiration, with a plan, with an experience that puts them on a course that changes the world? It's because in doing so they found perspective. They understood the larger picture in a way that wasn't possible in the bustle of everyday life. Silencing the noise around them, they could finally hear the quiet voice they needed to listen to. Creativity is a matter of receptiveness and recognition. This cannot happen if you're convinced the world revolves around you. By removing ego, even temporarily, we can access what's standing in relief. By widening our perspective, more comes into view. It's sad how disconnected from the past and from the future most of us really are. We forget that woolly mammoths walked the earth while the pyramids were being built. We don't realize that Cleopatra lived closer to our time than she did to the construction of those famous pyramids that marked her kingdom. When British workers excavated the land in Trafalgar Square to build Nelson's Column and its famous stone lions, in the ground they found bones of actual lions who'd roamed that exact spot just a few thousand years before. Someone recently calculated that it takes but a chain of 6 individuals who shook hands with one another across the centuries to connect Barack Obama to George Washington. There's a video you can watch on YouTube of a man on a CBS game show, I've Got a Secret, in 1956, in an episode that also happened to feature a famous actress named Lucille Ball. His secret? He was in Ford's Theater when Lincoln was assassinated. The English government only recently paid off debts it incurred as far back as 1720 from events like the South Sea Bubble, the Napoleonic Wars, the Empire's abolition of slavery, and the Irish potato famine, meaning that in the 21st century, there was still a direct and daily connection to the 18th and 19th centuries. As our power and talents grow, we like to think that makes us special, that we live in blessed, unprecedented times. This is compounded by the fact that so many of the photos we see from even 50 years ago are still in black and white. we seem to assume that the world was in black and white. Obviously, it wasn't. Their sky was the same color as ours, in some places brighter than ours. They bled the same way we did, and their cheeks got flushed just like ours do. We are just like them and always will be. It's hard to be humble when you're as great as I am, Muhammad Ali once said. Yeah, okay. That's why great people have to work even harder to fight against this headwind. It's hard to be self-absorbed and convinced of your own greatness inside the solitude and quiet of a sensory deprivation tank. It's hard to be anything but humble, walking alone on a beach late at night with an endless black ocean crashing loudly against the ground next to you. We have to actively seek out this cosmic sympathy. There's the famous Blake poem that opens with, "To see a world in a grain of sand, and a heaven in a wild flower, hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour." That's what we're after here. That's the transcendental experience that makes our petty ego impossible. Feel unprotected against the elements or forces or surroundings. Remind yourself how pointless it is to rage and fight and try to one-up those around you. Go and put yourself in touch with the infinite and end your conscious separation from the world. Reconcile yourself a bit better with the realities of life. Realize how much came before you and how only wisps of it remain. Let the feeling carry you as long as you can. Then when you start to feel better or bigger than, go and do it again. Maintain your sobriety. The height of cultivation runs to simplicity. Bruce Lee. Angela Merkel is the antithesis of nearly every assumption we make about a head of state, especially a German one. She is plain, she is modest, she cares little for presentation or flash, she gives no fiery speeches, she has no interest in expansion or domination. Mostly, she is quiet and reserved. Chancellor Angela Merkel is sober, when far too many leaders are intoxicated with ego, with power, with position. This sobriety is precisely what has made her a wildly popular three-term leader and, paradoxically, a powerful sweeping force for freedom and peace in modern Europe. There's a story about Merkel as a young girl at a swimming lesson. She walked out on the diving board and stood there, thinking about whether she should jump. Minutes ticked by. More minutes. Finally, just as the bell marking the end of the lesson began to ring, she jumped. Was she afraid or just cautious? Many years later, she would remind Europe's leaders during a major crisis that fear is a bad advisor. As a kid on that diving board, she wanted to use every allotted second to make the right decision, not driven by recklessness or fear. In most cases, we think that people become successful through sheer energy and enthusiasm. We almost excuse ego because we think it's part and parcel of the personality required to make it big. Maybe a bit of that overpoweringness is what got you where you are. But let's ask, is it really sustainable for the next several decades? Can you really outwork and outrun everyone forever? The answer is no. The ego tells us we're invincible, that we have unlimited force that will never dissipate. But that can't be what greatness requires. Energy without end? Merkel is the embodiment of Aesop's fable about the tortoise. She is slow and steady. The historic night the Berlin Wall fell, she was 35. She had one beer, went to bed, and showed up early for work the next day. A few years later, she had worked to become a respected but obscure physicist. Only then did she enter politics. In her 50s, she became chancellor. It was a diligent, plodding path. Yet the rest of us want to get to the top as fast as humanly possible. We have no patience for waiting. We're high on getting high up in the ranks. Once we've made it, we tend to think that ego and energy is the only way to stay there. It's not. When Russian President Vladimir Putin once attempted to intimidate Merkel by letting his large hunting dog barge into a meeting, she is reportedly not a dog lover, she didn't flinch and later joked about it. As a result, he was the one who looked foolish and insecure. During her rise, and especially during her time in power, she has consistently maintained her equilibrium and clear-headedness, regardless of the immediate stressors or stimuli. In a similar position, we might have sprung into bold action. We might have gotten angry or drawn a line in the sand. We have to stand up for ourselves, right? But do we? So often this is just ego, escalating tension more than dealing with it. Merkel is firm, clear, and patient. She's willing to compromise on everything except the principle at stake, which far too many people lose sight of. That is sobriety. That is command of oneself. She did not become the most powerful woman in the Western world by accident. More importantly, she's maintained her perch for three terms, the same formula. The great philosopher king Marcus Aurelius knew this very well. Called to politics almost against his will, he served the Roman people in continually higher offices from his teens until his death. There was almost always pressing business, appeals to hear, wars to fight, laws to pass, favors to grant. He strove to escape what he called imperialization, the stain of absolute power that had wrecked previous emperors. To do that, he wrote to himself, he must fight to be the person philosophy tried to make you. This is why one Zen philosopher is supposed to have called out to himself every day, "Master? Yes, sir." Then he would add, "Become sober." "Yes, sir." He would conclude by saying, "Do not be deceived by others." "Yes, sir. Yes, sir." Today we might add to that, "Don't be deceived by recognition you have gotten or the amount of money in your bank account." We have to fight to stay sober, despite the many different forces swirling around our ego. The historian Shelby Foote observed that power doesn't so much corrupt, that's too simple. It fragments, closes options, mesmerizes. That's what ego does. It clouds the mind precisely when it needs to be clear. Sobriety is a counterbalance, a hangover cure, or better, a prevention method. Other politicians are bold and charismatic, but as Merkel supposedly said, you can't solve tasks with charisma. She is rational. She analyzes. She makes it about the situation, not about herself, as people in power often do. Her background in science is helpful here, surely. Politicians are often vain, obsessing about their image. Merkel is too objective for that. She cares about the results and little else. A German writer observed in a tribute on her 50th birthday that unpretentiousness is Merkel's main weapon. David Halberstam, writing about Patriots coach Bill Belichick, observed that the man was not only in the steak business, he had contempt for sizzle. You could say the same about Merkel. Leaders like Belichick and Merkel know that steak is what wins games and moves nations forward. Sizzle, on the other hand, makes it harder to make the right decisions, how to interact with others, who to promote, which plays to run, what feedback to listen to, where to come down on an issue. Churchill's Europe required one type of leader. Today's interconnected world requires its own. Because there's so much information to be sorted through, so much competition, so much change, without a clear head, all is lost. We're not talking about abstinence from drugs or alcohol, obviously, but there certainly is an element of restraint to egoless sobriety, an elimination of the unnecessary and the destructive. No more obsessing about your image, treating people beneath you or above you with contempt, needing first-class trappings and the star treatment, raging, fighting, preening, performing, lording over, condescending and marveling at your own awesomeness or self-anointed importance. Sobriety is the counterweight that must balance out success, especially if things keep getting better and better. As James Basford remarked, it requires a strong constitution to withstand repeated attacks of prosperity. Well, that's where we are now. There's an old line about how if you want to live happy, live hidden. It's true. The problem is, that means the rest of us are deprived of really good examples. We're lucky to see someone like Merkel in the public eye, because she is the representative of a very large, silent majority. As hard as it might be to believe from what we see in the media, there are actually some successful people with modest apartments. Like Merkel, they have normal private lives with their spouses. Her husband skipped her first inauguration. They lack artifice. They wear normal clothes. Most successful people are people you've never heard of. They want it that way. It keeps them sober. It helps them do their jobs. For what often comes next, ego is the enemy. The evidence is in, and you are the verdict. Anne Lamott. Here you are at the pinnacle. What have you found? Just how tough and tricky it is to manage. You thought it would get easier when you arrived. Instead, it's even harder. A different animal entirely. What you found is that you must manage yourself in order to maintain your success. The philosopher Aristotle was not unfamiliar with the worlds of ego and power and empire. His most famous pupil was Alexander the Great. Partially through Aristotle's teachings, the young man conquered the entire known world. Alexander was brave and brilliant and often generous and wise. Still, it's clear that he ignored Aristotle's most important lesson, and that's partially why he died at age 32, far from home, likely killed by his own men, who had finally said, enough. It's not that he was wrong to have great ambitions. Alexander just never grasped Aristotle's golden mean, that is, the middle ground. Aristotle repeatedly speaks of virtue and excellence as points along a spectrum. Courage, for instance, lies between cowardice on one end and recklessness on the other. Generosity, which we all admire, must stop short of either profligacy and parsimony in order to be of any use. Where the line, this golden mean, is, can be difficult to tell, but without finding it, we risk dangerous extremes. This is why it is so hard to be excellent. As Aristotle wrote, in each case, it is hard work to find the intermediate. For instance, not everyone, but only one who knows, finds the midpoint in a circle. We can use the golden mean to navigate our ego and our desire to achieve. Endless ambition is easy. Anyone can put their foot down hard on the gas. Complacency is easy too. It's just a matter of taking that foot off the gas. We must avoid what the business strategist Jim Collins terms the undisciplined pursuit of more, as well as the complacency that comes with plaudits. To borrow from Aristotle again, what's difficult is to apply the right amount of pressure at the right time, in the right way, for the right period of time, in the right car, going in the right direction. If we don't do this, the consequences can be dire. There is a line from Napoleon who, like Alexander, died miserably. He said, "Men of great ambition have sought happiness and have found fame." What he means is that behind every goal is the drive to be happy and fulfilled. But when egotism takes hold, we lose track of our goal and end up somewhere we never intended. Emerson, in his famous essay on Napoleon, takes pains to point out that just a few years after his death, Europe was essentially exactly as it was before Napoleon began his precipitous rise. All that death, that effort, that greed, those honors, for what? For basically nothing. Napoleon, he wrote, quickly faded away, just like the smoke from his artillery. Howard Hughes, despite his current reputation as some kind of bold maverick, was not a happy man, no matter how awesome his life may seem from history or movies. When he was near death, one of his aides sought to reassure a suffering Hughes. "What an incredible life you have led," the aide said. Hughes shook his head and replied with the sad, emphatic honesty of someone whose time has clearly come. "If you had ever swapped places in life with me," he said, "I would be willing to bet that you would have demanded to swap back before the passage of the first week." We do not have to follow in those footsteps. We know what decisions we must make to avoid that ignominious, even pathetic end, protecting our sobriety, eschewing greed and paranoia, staying humble, retaining our sense of purpose, connecting to the larger world around us.